Okay, you might want to get close to your radio.
My deal is we can have an honest conversation where both sides have some issues.
I love it.
I want to officially welcome you to News One Now with Roland Martin.
I'm Roland Martin. Today on News One Now, housing discrimination is still real in 2015. Housing Secretary Leon Castro is here to talk about what he is doing to end it. There's a new dash cam video of the deadly shooting in South Carolina of Walter Scott. We will discuss it with our panel. Also, Soledad O'Brien joins me to talk about her latest documentary, Kids Behind Bars, on Al Jazeera America. Also, Wendy Raquel Robinson from The Game and Leon from The Five Heartbeats talks about twerking. Yeah, and the importance of black theater. Plus, a little power outage didn't stop Oprah from making a tremendous tribute to Dr. Maya Angelou. We'll show you. Plus, Empire star Taraji P. Henson will host Saturday Night Live this weekend. It's time to bring the funk on News One Now on TV One. Many people think housing discrimination ended with the Fair Housing Act in the late 60s, but the reality is it still exists. Yes, in 2015. It impacts us all across this country, but it's not just a question of housing discrimination. We also have to contend with what has taken place in the housing market for the past 7 years, especially for African Americans, where 53% of black wealth was wiped out as a result of the home foreclosure crisis. What is going to be done about that? Well, we talk right now to Leon Castro. He's the Secretary for Housing and Urban Development. He joins us right now. How you doing, sir?
Doing well.
All right, good seeing you.
Yeah.
I want to first start with the issue of the home foreclosure issue, because that's where most Americans are able to get their wealth, through ownership of their home. And what we have seen with the foreclosure crisis the last 7 years, African Americans adversely impacted. What specifically is HUD doing to deal with, to make sure that homeowners are being able to have those mortgages adjusted, dealing with those banks as well? Because forcing folks to become renters versus owners makes it difficult for them to be able to build wealth, to be able to pass it on to their children.
You're right. You know, Roland, in fact, as you know, throughout American history, the creation of wealth has really been tied up in home ownership, and that's the American dream. And so we have every interest in the administration ensuring that folks can hold on to their homes and build that wealth. And over the last several years, particularly during the depths of the housing crisis, the Obama administration invested resources to ensure that folks could stay in their homes. That continues to this day. And at HUD, we've taken on new programs like our distressed asset sales program, where lenders are to work with borrowers to try and keep them in their homes. The goal is really to ensure that that communities stay whole and that that dream of home ownership is real for Americans.
One of the things that also jumps out when you talk about that is providing the necessary information that those homeowners need. And when you talk about housing discrimination, we also dealt with predatory lending when it came to subprime loans. And so what role is HUD playing to ensure that doesn't happen again, where people who didn't qualify, who frankly qualify for better loans, were forced into those type of loans?
You know, there have been a series of steps that have been taken to strengthen the rules of the road, if you will. Today we have something called the qualified mortgage, for instance, that dictates what types of loans are going to be insured and securitized. At FHA, it's important to note, under HUD, FHA never engaged in the kind of use of toxic products that led to the housing crisis that we had. It has always been a steady way to provide opportunity, particularly for first-time home buyers and folks of modest means, and especially African Americans and Latinos, Asian Americans. Today at FHA, which is under HUD, almost 50% of African Americans out there who are first-time home buyers and get a home loan, it's an FHA-insured home loan. So that is a real vehicle for ensuring that they're good, solid loans and that opportunity exists.
One of the things that jumps out when we talk about the role that banks play in lending, I remember when I was getting my first home, and one of the banks wanted, it was amazing, so they saw financial information, they saw all that sort of stuff. They even began to say, well, no, we need to see deposit slips to prove income. And I'm going, what the hell are you talking about? I mean, and I knew for a fact that that was not what was required. And so when we talk about housing discrimination, what are you actually seeing out there, the sophisticated ways that folks are being discriminated against today?
Yeah, first of all, as you noted at the beginning of the segment, housing discrimination is not something that's just in the past. It is something that is happening in 2015. And at HUD, we have a fair housing office that is charged with going out there and ferreting it out. So we have everything from testers that go out and test the market. Through our research, we found, for instance, that renters who are African American who call about listings are shown, are told about 12% fewer listings than the mainstream, than whites. Latinos are usually told about 11% less listings, and Asian Americans told about 10% less listings. We have received over the last 4 or 5 years about 40,000 complaints on different types of housing discrimination that has led to about $105 million worth of settlement. Mm-hmm. It's also important to note that there's racial discrimination, but it's also discrimination against folks, for instance, women who are pregnant.
Pull that graphic up, please, Shelley. Yeah, you talk about race, national origin, maternity lending, disability, domestic violence survivors, and families with children. I mean,
yeah,
those are all the different ways that folks is,
that's right,
because they don't want certain folks living in certain places.
Yeah, folks often think of this in a one-dimensional way, but people with disabilities, for instance, who go in there and try and get a home loan or trying to get an apartment, and the landlord just is not interested because they think they're going to have to make special accommodations. Or when a woman who's pregnant goes into a bank and tries to get a home loan, we've seen instances where the lenders won't lend because they think, no, you're not going to go back to work after you have the baby. It is a multidimensional or three-dimensional challenge, and we invite folks to, if they think that they're being discriminated against, to take action. We've gotten into the 21st century now. We have an app, a housing discrimination complaint application that mm-hmm. folks can get on Android phones or iPhones. We have a hotline number that folks can call. The goal of this is that in this country, the abiding principle has been equality and opportunity. And that cannot be real unless, no matter who you are, when you go into the housing market, you know that you're going to get a fair shot at getting a rental or at owning a home. And that's HUD's mission, to try and make that a reality.
And what folks, I think, have to understand is that when you look at the practices that took place, the Jim Crow practices, where African Americans for years were forced to live in certain areas, that's a direct correlation in terms of property values, your ability to resell that home. If there are higher property values and you can sell that home at a much higher price, that's more money you're able to get back, and you can save and invest. And so I think a lot of people don't understand literally how there's a continuum and how that sole decision to keep you from living or buying in a certain place could have an impact on your children being able to have money to be able to afford college or buy their first home.
No doubt. It was all about wealth creation. And, you know, I think that starts with an acknowledgement that at institutions like FHA in the past, which now is doing everything it can to expand opportunity, sometimes, was complicit in limiting opportunity. We've turned that around over the last several mm-hmm. decades, and today the charge that we have is to ensure that everybody gets a fair shot. And my hope is that as our nation continues to progress to that colorblind society that all of us want, that we will see less and less of this. In the meantime, we're going to play our role mm-hmm. in working with Americans who are being discriminated against to ensure that they can get an equal opportunity to get a good home.
Shelley, pull the number up, please. The number you can call, folks, the HUD Fair Housing Hotline is 1-800-669-9777, 1-800-669-9777. And also the app again is?
The app is the Housing Discrimination Complaint Application. I know that it's not a sexy name, but it's an effective app.
Y'all might want to shorten that up a little bit. That's right. I got to put all that in the search box trying to find it. All right. Secretary Castro, I sure appreciate it. Thanks so much. Good seeing
you.
Thank you. All right, folks, coming up, a new dash cam video releasing the shooting of Walter Scott. Another witness comes forward. We'll talk about it with our panel. Plus, Soledad O'Brien joins me to discuss her new documentary. It dissects the number of young folks of color being in prison at an alarming rate. Also, Wendy Wakil Robinson and Leon will chat about all the things happening in their life, including what happens on the stage. And Oprah That's right. When she paid tribute to Dr. Maya Angelou earlier this week, she was interrupted with a power crash, but it didn't stop the most powerful woman from continuing. Phenomenal woman. You don't want to miss this, folks. Trust me. 9 after the hour. News 1 Now on TV 1.
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News 1 Now with your host, Roland Martin.
New video shows the start of the fatal encounter between Walter Scott and Officer Michael Slager in North Charleston, South Carolina. We're going to show you the video right now. What started off as a routine traffic stop where Slager stopped Scott for a broken taillight. And so this is a dash cam video. Was Slager. He gets out of the car. He's talking to Walter Scott. And he tells him to get back in. Then at a certain point, we're going to keep playing this video. Scott all of a sudden gets out of the car and bolts. Now, what we don't see is any particular altercation that actually took place between the two. Slager, of course, said that Scott tried to take his taser gun. And so all of a sudden, again, you see there where Scott takes off running. And there still is a passenger in the car who was also there. And so we'll discuss with our panel, Attorney Mitwin Charles, legal analyst and principal of Mitwin Charles and Associates, Ray Baker of Ray Baker Media, and George Jefferson Nuri, founder of In the Public Eye Communications. Mitwin, looking at this dash cam video, and listening to other attorneys, one of the things that they say is that at no point was Scott being detained. At no point was he in custody. So for Slager to pursue him, Slager was not necessarily operating within the law and also having to use deadly force once he actually caught up with Scott.
That's right, Roland. Not only was he not necessarily being detained, but according to the video, he never appeared to pose a threat. Usually when a police officer is going to use deadly force, they have to feel an imminent sense of danger or bodily harm from that person, or the person is a fleeing felon who has the potential to harm someone else. That wasn't the case here. So one of the biggest problems with this video is it doesn't even appear as though they even were in close proximity to each other, such that this officer would feel a sense of immediate threat for his life. And it's one of the most disturbing things about this video is that it starts out, like a lot of other cases right. That we keep hearing about, as a minor infraction. This guy isn't a terrorist. He didn't just kill someone. He wasn't on the lam like Eric Freen for 9 weeks hiding in the woods in Pennsylvania. So the idea that a black man would lose his life for something that started out as so minor is what makes this all the more gut-wrenching.
Well, what gets me is, again, the decision to, okay, it's a broken taillight.
Yeah.
And so Slager pursues him for a broken taillight and sees a need to pull out his taser and fire it into Scott. Well, then he says, well, there's some kind of altercation, and then he needs to pull out his gun and fire 8 times. I mean, again, for me, it's a broken taillight. If I, here's what I'm looking at. I'm a cop. His car is back there.
How far is he going?
I can go to his house. Now, he can run all day if he want to, but I will be able to track him down. I got his car.
Well, even if the officer, in doing the search with the driver's license, found that Walter Scott is wanted on a bench warrant for failure to pay his child support, and he's wanted on a couple other things that are minor infractions, even at that point, you don't chase him down the street and shoot him. You can still go to his house. You can deliver the bench warrant to his home. You don't chase him down the street and shoot him. I'm wondering what triggered, except for no black man runs from me, or I'm the cops and I get to tell you what to do.
Oh, no doubt.
Would trigger you to run down the street and shoot somebody.
Well, we have the Minneapolis video where the cop pulls over black kid and tells him, I will break your effing leg if you run.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
I don't play. Don't mess with me. Mm-hmm. And the kid is going, officer, what are you talking about? I was not trying to run. He said, no, I'm just letting you know. And then he said, I'm being officer friendly. And so what gets me is you have all these folks who say, well, what causes this man to run? Look, I've seen white folks take off and run. The bottom line is, if somebody's sitting here, same thing, got a bench warrant, child support.
Right.
I mean, look, take off. But the logic of let me pull my gun out and shoot and kill you, Ray. Hold on a second, Ray. I'm not getting that logic.
And you're not going to, because the four of us sitting up here, it's as well reasoned and logical folks, will not understand whatever type of evil pathology lies within someone that forces them to take the point of authority to someone else's life. And that's what it is here. And whether you're talking about Minneapolis, whether we're talking about what we saw in Ferguson when the Department of Justice report told us, they said, I'm the police, I can lock up who I want to. Whether we're talking about what we saw in Arizona where a law officer said, I thought it was a pill bottle in a man's pocket, so I shot him. We can't keep trying to justify reasons for insanity.
Well, you know, amazing, because I'm wondering why good cops, I know there's this code among cops that they defend themselves, but I'm wondering why police unions and officers who consider themselves good cops are not stepping forward and joining the forces that say, let's weed this out.
Easy.
Let's talk
Easy.
About this attitude.
It's because it's protection. Mm-hmm. And that is because that same officer is thinking, I might find myself in a situation where I'm in trouble and I'm going to want that union to back me every step of the way. There was another witness who also spoke out about what took place. And so let's roll that video.
I don't know if it was a fight, but it was a tussle. When I came to the corner of the Advance Auto parking lot and saw them, it was a tussle.
Okay, so that's Gwen Nichols, so she saw the tussle. Again, what you have is, first of all, for people out there understanding, he's been charged. He has not been indicted. That's critically important. So the question is, will this DA...
It's a bench warrant for child support.
No. So speaking of Slager.
So
here are the legal questions that now come up.
Right.
Will the district attorney simply take it right to a trial? Mm-hmm. Because most people assume you have to get indicted. You don't have to get indicted. Okay, so we don't know yet whether or not the DA will pursue a grand jury indictment, mm-hmm. or will he simply follow the police in charge? We also have to keep in mind that how these things get drawn out. The officer who killed Jonathan Farrell in Charlotte, North Carolina, first grand jury did not indict him for killing Farrell. The state attorney general took the case over in North Carolina. Another grand jury indicted him on manslaughter. He was indicted in January 2013. This is 2014. This is April 2015. That still has not gone to trial. And so I know a lot of people are sitting here saying, oh, you know, justice is being served, but he's only been charged.
Yeah, but I'd be surprised if this didn't sort of get on the fast track of a trial. One of the things that I think is remarkably different with this case is the way the police department in this community handled the case. They immediately came forward, fired him, distanced themselves from this police officer, and said this is not something
also
that
led by the mayor
tolerate.
Too.
Yeah, and
right.
They also involved the family and treated the family as though they were real victims, which is something we never saw
right.
in Ferguson with Mike Brown or New York. With Eric Garner.
In New York or Cleveland.
Exactly.
We can go down the line.
Right. So this the entire environment regarding
right.
this case is remarkably different with respect to how law enforcement and elected officials in that community have handled this.
Ray, real quick.
One of the things that's disheartening is that the mere arrest of this officer is now cause for celebration among communities of color that we may get justice.
Yeah, because in this country, I keep telling people, it's not a shock when a cop doesn't get arrested or gets indicted. It's a shock when that person does,
right.
because that's what rarely ever happens.
But I don't have the faith in the criminal justice system that would say to me that there will not be something that will say between the dash cam camera
right.
and this witness and his cell phone that something happened here, that his lawyers,
right.
the police officer's lawyers, this man may still walk away.
Well, here's the deal.
I'm going to rebuke that.
Remember,
there was nothing that could have happened between the time he pulled him over and the time he shot him in the back. That would justify that.
I agree with you.
Yeah, 100%. So I'm going to rebuke that.
But
I don't
here's
have
the deal.
Anything.
And when one thing, we never know what in the world is in the mind of jurors as
Thank
well.
Thank you.
So hold tight 1 second. When we come back, we're going to chat with a veteran journalist, Soledad O'Brien, talk about her new Al Jazeera America documentary, Kids Behind Bars. What up, Soledad? Stop texting me. All right. And who says beauty queens have to be a size 2? The Miss Four-Figured USA pageant winner and founder would join me to talk about the issue of how people view themselves. Plus, Leon and Wendy Raquel Robinson talk about the hit play, What Your Man Won't Do. 23 after the hour, News 1 Now on TV 1.
The first step is to join the movement.
Begin to mobilize and move people to action now.
Step number two, roll out.
The way I roll is when you've shown one time you can do it, no excuses after that.
We're your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with Roland Martin. Roland Martin.
Folks, the School of Prison Pipeline is alive and well in America. More than 60,000 folks on the age of 21 are currently behind bars. That's right, 60,000. Award-winning journalist Loretta O'Brien produced a new documentary for Al Jazeera America that shines light on this epidemic. Here's a look at kids behind bars.
You know, I don't really think this program's helping me.
No, why not?
It's not something that I need.
Is part of the theory that if you think about it and talk about it and kind of work through it, that you come out the other side better?
Honestly, I think this place has just made me a better criminal.
How do you mean?
I've learned more stuff than I would learn on the outs.
Joining us right now from New York via Skype is Soledad O'Brien. What up, Soledad?
Hey, nice to talk to you, Roland.
So the thing that really jumps out at me on this here is that this speaks to us as a nation where we have the view of lock them up and throw away the key. Doesn't matter if they are adults. Doesn't matter if they are young folks. This is the best way for us to deal with folks that we consider to be trouble.
Yeah, I think we've often looked at juvenile justice and, in fact, the justice system as a whole in America as in a way, a little schizophrenically, right? We don't really know what we want as the outcome. So in the past, and certainly this story takes place in Las Cruces, New Mexico, they would put these kids in solitary confinement. There were allegations of horrific physical and sexual abuse taking place within this juvenile justice system. And so what they started thinking about was, well, how should it be? I mean, if the goal is to rehabilitate the kids, then what do you need to do while they're in to sort of change the trajectory? If the goal is to lower recidivism rates, what do you need to do? And who are the kids that need to be in the system? That kid, Kedrick, who we just played that soundbite of, goes on to talk about, as much as he's saying he's becoming a better criminal, talks about the guard who is a mentor to him, and then goes on to say, and I miss him because he's taken this week off. And there's just one other staffer who's really been like a dad to me, you know? And so as much as Kedrick likes to say, this is doing nothing for me, at the same time, he, you know, the guards now act as mentors and counselors under this new system called Cambiar in New Mexico. And you really see the changes that they're trying to bring in the hopes of using the time that these kids are incarcerated to rehabilitate them.
Well, what jumps out at me and what bothers me the most is when you talk about this notion of rehabilitating, and the reality is that's not how the general public deals with it. I mean, because we, oh my goodness, take away their cable television, take away these things. And then all of a sudden, when a person comes out, it's no shock that they don't have any skill set because there was no real effort to rehabilitate them. Charles Dutton was on the show. Look, when he was in prison, he said, you know, that's what I learned acting, and that was my way out. He said, Roland, I go to prison now. You got cats sitting there for 30, 40, 50 years. They have no hope of really getting out. So they say, look, he said, rehabilitation doesn't even exist anymore.
And imagine if you're talking about a 17-year-old or 15-year-old or 16-year-old. Are you willing to say that this kid's life really has no value? You're going to lock him up for 2-3 years, whatever, and then put him back into the outside with no education, no ability to kind of learn how to manage a lot of the traumatic experiences these kids, and just bad experiences these kids have either perpetrated themselves or have been through. You know, what they do differently in this particular program that we profiled is, for example, if there is a fight, and we, you know, show a couple of fights that were caught on camera, what they do is they won't put the kids in solitary confinement, which is what they used to do. They bring them down. Now they have to all sit down as a group and talk about what precipitated the fight, how did the fight go, who was responsible, who's going to take the blame for the fight, and they will discuss it as a group. It's a really different kind of strategy than what they used to do in the past before Cambiar came in 2010, which was this kid goes this way, locked up, this kid goes this way, solitary, and they just separate them and no one kind of works through what happened.
Soledad, good morning. This is Ray Baker. Are the young people that you're talking to aware of the injustice of some of their charges? We saw in Nevada that they're thinking about making a felony out of repeat graffiti usage. So are the young people aware that I'm coming in for some minor, what we would call a minor infraction, and as you saw from your young person in the clip, they're now finding out how to be better criminals. Are they aware of that?
Yeah, you know, I think they don't. I think most of these kids are undereducated. They're in poverty. In many cases, their own parents are in gangs, or they're, you know, sort of a low-level member of a gang. So for them to even understand the debate around their charges, I think that's way over their heads. I think they think of themselves as bad kids. You know, no one has really ever said, well, actually, you know, there's an opportunity to change. So, no, none of the conversations we had did the kids sort of think, like, I want to challenge why I'm here. They were like, being called a client or being called a prisoner doesn't matter. That's semantics. You know, I'm a bad kid, I'm a bad dude, and I don't like it here, and I don't need to grow. That was much more the conversation we were having. Unless they were in for a little bit and they sort of realized that they wanted to change and they wanted to have opportunities on the outside. I think the real tragedy, frankly, is that when they get out, you know, it's really, really hard with a record, with leaving a bad and dysfunctional situation at home, with kind of everything that they've been through. I think the chances that they're going to be successful on the outside, are low or challenging.
Hi, Soledad. It's Midwin. How are you?
Hey, Midwin. Nice to talk to you.
Good to talk to you, too. I had a question with respect to the sort of programs that these young people are sort of exposed to, or any at all. Is there any opportunity for them to grow?
Full day of school, which is unusual. So they are in school. For those who are out of high school and have graduated from high school, or they can do a GED, a program as well. So that's, I think, kind of standard when you start thinking about juvenile facilities that think about education at all. And then just a lot of counseling, a one-on-one counseling session, a group counseling session. The people who we would think of as the guards in the program are literally assigned as mentors. So you have these young men who have these mostly male figures in their lives who are their mentors to just discuss and navigate their way through. Those guards get about 6 weeks of training so that they can be mentors and pseudo counselors, I would call them. And then there's, you know, exercise program, of course. So there are a number of programs that they're trying to see if they can, you know, kind of change how the juvenile detention is set up. And if you look at the pictures inside the room, it's couches, it's like a common room. It reminds me of kind of the space in your college where everyone can kind of hang out, kind of grungy in their couches. Very different than what it used to be, which was a table that was bolted down with chairs that were also bolted down.
The documentary, folks, Kids Behind Bars, airs on Sunday on Al Jazeera America at 10 p.m. Eastern. It's a Soledad O'Brien special report. Soledad, I appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
It's my pleasure. Thanks, Roland. Nice to talk to you.
Likewise. Coming up, folks, Leon and Wendy Raquel Robinson of the hit play Things Your Man Won't Do. We'll talk twerking. Yeah, y'all don't want to miss that. Plus, the reigning Miss Full Figured USA 2014 joins us to talk about pageant experience, but also the issue of how people view themselves as opposed to how mainstream media depicts what is beautiful. All of that next on News 1 Now on TV 1.
So you want the truth. Well, we got it.
That's how I talk. God knows it. I'm just straight.
It's News 1 Now.
Wendy Raquel Robinson, Leon and Jacarius Johnson dropped by my show recently to talk about their hit play, Things a Man Won't Do. And we got to end up talking about twerking with Wendy. Check this out.
Tasha Mack, I did a whole ad lib on
the
show.
You need to flash, folks.
I do. Tweet that, twerk that, work that. Boom. Okay? That was the ad lib that I did on the game. And it was just something I threw out to Lauren London. Bam.
Hold on. You need to flash them again.
Okay. Hey. Well, Twerk.com. Okay, yeah, exactly. Wait, no. Look, because this is important, Roland.
Okay, I'm sorry. Go ahead.
So I did an ad lib. They ended up writing it into the show.
Right.
Then cut to, boom, I have Amazing Grace Conservatory that I co-founded 18 years ago. It's my nonprofit.
So you're twerking to Amazing Grace.
Right, exactly. Okay. Because this all makes sense. I know it's the way I think. That's why my man will do whatever I need him to do, and I couldn't think of anything. So anyway, so cut to, I had Tweet That, Twerk That, Work That. That was my first shirt. But then all my kids were wearing Twerk That and this, and I was like, I need to redefine it. Because I want my young ladies to know there is a difference between Miley Cyrus and this and showing your body. Ladies, let's be respectful.
Girl, she can't.
Okay, well, whatever. You asked me how I got it.
I call her Miley Titus.
Go to workthatwendy.com, honey.
Workthatwendy.com.
And all proceeds go to my nonprofit. We're paying off the building.
Leon, what you think?
I
I think it's fantastic.
Yeah. It's fantastic.
I think it's fantastic.
And ladies, trust me, the men will love it. You will love it. It's wonderful.
Anytime you can take pop culture and turn it into something good,
yeah,
you know, I think it's fantastic.
Thank you, Mia.
That's Robinson and Robinson.
We're Robinson.
All right, so what is it about a play that's different from television and movies?
Wow.
Is it no net?
You're in the moment. You can't stop, holla, cut. It's just
reaction.
Like this.
Yeah, we don't, you know, when we do television and film, we don't ever get to see how the audience reacts to
right.
what we're doing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a
not
totally different
all.
Thing. And plus, if you're a trained actor, that's how you learn is on the stage. So you're like going back home.
So what happens when...
Or then you're getting paid this time.
So what, right, which is kind of important. So what happens when you're on stage and the audience reacts and you are like, oh, what in the hell was I supposed to say?
You go with it. Then, you got to go with the flow.
And y'all just improvising.
You got it. Just like what we're doing right now.
And your parents, you're sitting there like, what the hell are y'all doing?
Yeah. You guys are ruining my
most
script.
Most of the time.
But in reality, you should be in your character.
Mm-hmm. Right.
So you know where the scene is going. So even if you don't say the words exactly how they're supposed to be said, you're going to say something that's going to move the scene along.
But kind of like, what
so,
would
so,
Jesus
so what
say?
Happened when you just took it somewhere else?
Hopefully,
all the other actors got to go with it.
They'll go with it.
Right?
Yeah, and then someone will bring you back into it.
Now, is there a look where they look at you like, well, no, way, you going with this dog? Can you like get back on the script, please?
Well, you know, and lots of times, you know, as an actor, you have little things that you can work. Like me, I'm a type of guy that I'll chew up the scenery. So I'll just start prancing around the stage. Eventually, they'll come to me. And they'll be like, oh, yeah, that's right. You know what I'm saying? You know?
So that's your calling card. When you start moving around the stage, he came
out. Nobody
got
his line.
Most times it's written in.
You know what's interesting about this? And I just learned this time around. As a writer, I feel like when we start the show, I know more than anybody else about the character. Then as a director, I feel like I know more than me as a writer. As I begin to go through this process. And then at some point, working with skilled actors, they know more about the character they're playing than I do as the writer and the director, because they're the only ones getting up there living and breathing and interacting with other people who are living and breathing in the moment.
Next week, going deep with your characters.
And see, and I'll clown. They'll do all of that, but I'll clown on stage.
And are you looking at her like, what the hell is wrong with her sitting here just...
No, I would clown.
Wendy is probably the most
time.
Spontaneous, fastest person off the top of the head I've ever met when it comes
I'm sorry, Jacarius, I didn't quite hear that. Say it.
she's incredible. I mean,
yeah, she's fantastic in play.
What do you make of people who believe, oh, man, that a stage play thing, I ain't down with that. But the reality is, there is still a significant segment of the audience that enjoys... stage plays.
And this is Black Broadway. I mean, let's think about it. And I finance Broadway shows. So the reality is that Broadway, Black is not the audience for Broadway. So when actors only aspire to Broadway, they're already doing themselves a disservice because there's so few roles, so few opportunities, and we're not the demographic that is making you famous.
Wow.
So you're not even giving back to your fans by going to go do a Broadway. Mm-hmm. You're kind of serving just a personal goal. But the people who really make you who you are, that's who we're reaching when we tour across the country.
If you go to Broadway and you see even when Denzel stars in a play, even the Motown music, you go, the audience is predominantly white. They're using Black talent, Black stories for them to bring in
the ticket dollars
like that, as opposed to saying anything that's about our culture or anything. So it's, what's the difference? You're basically going to see the same reason why you would watch a show, whether it be Blackish or anything else, because you're seeing faces like us.
Yeah.
The same reason is the reason why you go to a play.
Bottom line is, you make the audience happy.
Absolutely.
That's the whole
you inspire
point.
Them.
Absolutely. Audience happy.
Something.
Like you talk about happy wife, happy life, happy audience. Y'all get paid. It's good.
There you go.
Look, people pay their money and they get their money's worth and they're happy. You said that's the name
that's
of the
key.
Game.
And it's a ministry in it as well. So you're getting everything. You laugh, you cry, and you get ministered.
All right, twerk it, work it.
That's
all right. We got Wendy Raquel Robinson, Leon Jacarez. I appreciate it. Thank
you
so very much.
Players, just watch the game. Season 9. Amen.
Dang,
shameless plug.
I know, shameless. She gonna get cussed out though, too, because you know, you know the game ain't on this network. But she gonna get cussed out. Don't worry about it.
Man. I'm sorry.
It's all good.
But see, it's for us, by us, and it's about us.
But it doesn't
see,
mean
here we
you
go.
Know she gonna get
the
cussed out. Don't worry about it. She's gonna get cussed out.
We're all family.
Doesn't
we're
mean
all
the talent
one.
Can't be on this.
We're
network.
All one.
Yes, all about
okay?
the Robinson.
We're all one.
We out.
Okay, you might want to get close to your radio.
My deal is we can have an honest conversation where both sides have some issues.
I love it.
I want to officially welcome you to News One Now with Roland Martin.
All right, folks, birthday shout out time. Singer Kenny Lattimore, he turns 45 years young. Rapper and producer Q-Tip also turns 45. Man, look at them, the Mr. Magoo glasses he got on. Actor Lando Jones turns 47. And actress Jasmine Guy, she turns 54. And super producer and singer Kenneth Babyface Edmonds, he turns 56. Something at 56. All right, Empire star Taraji P. Henson will host Saturday Night Live this weekend. That's going to be really interesting. Also, co-star, is it Jesse or Jesse? You know that boy named Jesse. You know that name, Jesse. Smollett shared his opinion about it with Hip Hollywood reporter Vanessa Barnett. Take a look at what he had to say.
Taraji P. Henson will be hosting SNL on Saturday, and according to her Empire co-star Jesse Smollett, she will do phenomenally.
To me, Taraji is the perfect example of someone that is as beautiful as they are funny and talented. You know, she, there's pretty much nothing that she can't do, and I say that not just because she's a friend, but it's really real. I feel like she's the love child of Samuel L. Jackson and Betty Davis or something. She just is crazy, and she's gonna smash it. They ain't ready.
Henson will make her SNL hosting debut this weekend alongside musical guest Mumford & Son. And she's already released a promo video where she channels her Empire character, Cookie Lion.
Taraji, you are great on Empire.
Thank you, Taryn.
You're not anything like your character Cookie in real life, are you?
And don't ask questions you won't like the answers to, little boy.
While fans will temporarily get their Cookie fix via SNL, Smollett told us season two will definitely be worth the wait.
Season one times 3 million. Yeah, they're taking it there.
We can't wait. For TV One and Hip Hollywood, I'm Vanessa Barnett.
All right, folks. For over 26 years, the Miss Full-Figured USA pageant has been proving that beauty has no size. It has three categories of crowns: Miss Full-Figured USA, Miss Full-Figured USA Plus, and Miss Exquisite Full-Figured USA. Y'all can't make up your mind on these categories? Today, we're joined by pageant finalist Teresa Sparkle Randolph and Miss Full-Figured USA 2014,
Najah Jahan.
All right, glad y'all are here. So, okay, so why'd you decide to create a pageant? First of all, because pageants already get on my nerves, just pageants.
They're beautiful.
These little kids' pageants, pageants.
Love it.
I mean, the tiaras and all that sort of stuff.
Love it.
But why'd you say, okay, I want to do this one?
Well, I knew that size had no barrier on beauty. I was always a plus-size woman, and I wanted to exude confidence and self-esteem in all full-figured women.
All right, so you create the pageant.
Right.
So how many folks participate?
Each year, about 20 to 25,
mm-hmm.
yes, women mm-hmm. from all over. And we have it in different states coming up, too. So it's fabulous for their self-esteem and everything.
So why did you want to do it?
I wanted to be Miss Full-Figured USA because of the benefits that I would receive and that I could empower women.
Like what are the benefits?
Benefits that self-esteem, confidence, empowering women, but empowering myself first. And just being a beacon of light to those who are coming up behind me. So.
One of the things that happened, we saw it this week, Lane Bryant has a new commercial out, and it features a full-figured women selling their... Y'all have the commercial? Y'all have it, right? Okay. Y'all don't have it? I thought y'all were playing it earlier. Okay, I thought they had it. I'll find it on my iPad.
Okay.
But anyway, in this particular commercial, they're showing these women, and they're sort of combating the Victoria's Secrets commercial. And so, for you, do you believe that as a society... the standard is one that, frankly, the general public, a general woman, can't fit. There is this notion of what is beauty.
Beauty is in the eye of the beholder, first of all. In this industry, size 14 is the average size in every household. The industry in every designer that I know of is trying to tap into the industry because it's a multi-million dollar industry. And we are the buying market, no matter how you look at it, in this society. And like I always say, size has no barrier on beauty, and we just exude that.
So how do you do the issue of health and wellness? I interviewed Monique recently, and Monique, for years, she talked, I mean, she had this whole thing where she slapped a skinny woman. So she said, no, I didn't say that. She said I hit one side of their head. And she, same thing, she talked about her beauty, she talked about having self-esteem. But all of a sudden, her husband, one day when she got on the scale, she said she was at 300 pounds. Mm-hmm. And her husband questioned her on that. And it caused her to reexamine that particular view. And so what about that issue of mixed messages? And what she said, that here I was saying, I'm proud of who I am. She said, but health is real.
Well, you have full-figured women that are healthy. You have thin people that are healthy, and then you have some that are not healthy, okay? You have to take nutrition, and you have to take your body very serious in your mind. You have to think about what you're putting in your body. Toxins can go inside full-figured people as far as thin people. And I just feel that you should work together and exercise yourself and just come up with a regimen for your mind, body, and soul.
Right, and most often people focus on the physical part of being, let's say, overweight. Mm-hmm. However, there's also the spiritual wellness. There's your mental wellness. So it isn't just one faceted. It's multifaceted.
All right, so when's the next pageant?
The next pageant is April the 18th. That's Saturday at the Robert Treat Hotel in Newark, New Jersey.
All right, it'll be in Newark. All right, then. Well, look, good luck with the pageant.
Thank you, Roland.
That's right. Don't celebrate too much because y'all don't have too much fun. Alcohol probably involved in the BS. That's right. All right, what's the website? Please pull the website up, please. Right now, it's MissFullFiguredUSA.com. All right, I appreciate it. Thanks a bunch.
Thank you.
When we come back, Oprah, phenomenal woman, celebrating death of Maya Angelou. You don't want to miss this. Back to Roland Martin in a moment.
Okay, government might have shut down.
Let's end this shutdown right now. Let's put people back to work.
Listen, there's never been a president in our history that did not negotiate over the debt limit. Never. Not once.
But you can count on us. Welcome to News One Now with Roland Martin.
All right, folks. On Tuesday, the U.S. Postal Service had their program honoring Dr. Maya Angelou and unveiling the Maya Forever stamp. Well, guess what? During the ceremony, there was a massive power outage all across D.C., affected the White House, Capitol Hill, but also the venue where we were, the Warner Theater. When the power outage hit, Oprah Winfrey was at the microphone, but Oprah said, I ain't let no power outage stop me from doing what I do. Check this out.
And I'm honored to be here to stand as her daughter, sister, friend at the unveiling of the Maya Forever stamp. She was a woman, phenomenal woman.
Oprah is going to sit here and do phenomenal woman in the dark, then just going to drop the mic and walk off. All right. So we wanted to show you that. All right, folks, you have a great day. I will see you on Monday. Holla!
Wherever you are, we are your centerpiece for Black thoughts in America. It's News One Now with your host, Roland Martin.